The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever, the show that looks at the intersection of mental health and work and how we can all do both better. Do you speak mental health? This is a serious question, and it's important, especially at work. It wasn't long ago that anything that happened in our work days was pretty much taken at face value, or we were just blamed for it. If your boss was a jerk, that's just who they were. There wasn't much consideration that they might be dealing with severe anxiety or other big stuff. And if you had a coworker that just didn't get their work done on time, you just assumed they were lazy, right? Not that they were maybe dealing with depression or trying to manage ADHD. And while workplaces and leaders are so much more aware and more open to adapting to the mental health challenges their teams might be facing, there's a long way to go. And so later on, we're going to speak with someone who's making it her mission to increase mental health literacy, not just in adults, but by starting young in K-12 education. Donna Volpita is the co-founder of the Mental Health Literacy Collaborative. But first, I want to share a conversation I had with Kent Cools, who I met in Hawaii. Kent has spent the last years of his career in Hawaii, where he's co-publisher at Hawaii Business Magazine. Kent is sober, but for much of his career, he struggled with alcoholism. He was still able to achieve big things in the media business, but he didn't really even know how much his substance use was masking anxiety until much later in life. And we talk about this. We kind of imagine what his life might have been like had he had better mental health literacy growing up. Could he have understood his anxiety earlier and how he masked it? Imagine how great an impact mental health literacy can have in the future if we start early. Well, you worked in the news business. You have worked in the news business for your whole career. Is that right?
Yeah, almost. I started a community newspaper in Santa Monica, California, and then I went to daily newspapers in Bakersfield, Minneapolis, and then finally Newark, New Jersey.
Wow.
Before moving to Hawaii, but not for newspapers. It was just a lifestyle change.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. My wife is from Hawaii. I'm not from Hawaii. Her father was born here, and she's part Hawaiian, and she moved here for summer school and then decided to drop out of college and work at a t-shirt shop in Waikiki because she loved it so much. Her grandparents, she visited here a lot as a kid, but then she stayed here a year living on rice and loved it and swore one day this was where she wanted to live. And so my two oldest kids went to University of Hawaii from New Jersey separately and apart, 2 years apart, made the individual decision. So they were here. And then we were producing events for newspapers and we were self-employed. And my wife finally said, we're in our early 50s. We're either going to move to Hawaii now or we're never going to do it. Because my youngest daughter was graduating eighth grade. So that's what we planned up. And that's how we ended up here.
To go from New Jersey to Hawaii is like a huge lifestyle shift, I would imagine. What fueled your interest in news? Like, what was it about daily news? Daily news is its own beast.
So I was editor of my high school paper. So originally I was going to be a journalist. I ended up falling back into newspapers, but I ended up on the sales side. So I ended up being in sales management. I've written for other publications I've worked for. You know, so I had an interest in writing at a young age, but I ended up falling into the sales side and stayed there. So my greatest satisfaction in working for the newspaper business, I always felt, was that I was supporting something that was very important to society and democracy. And I think that what you've seen happen with the demise of mainstream and local journalism over the last few years kind of supported what I thought was my reason for working for media in the first place. When you see how the proliferation of confirmation bias in today's society, just people, you know, they used to kind of at least be arguing about the same facts, and now we don't even have the same facts. So always very proud to say that I supported the newspaper industry.
My husband's favorite statistic to trot out is that journalism has lost more jobs in the past 15 years than the coal mining industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, the demise of local and state-based news is so profound. So, yes.
Well, and we see the effects of it every day, right? And now AI is just going to make it easier to create fake news.
That's right. You're right. It's the loss of a sort of shared vernacular of truth, isn't it? The reason I wanted to talk to you, although I respect, of course, your career in journalism, is something you said to me. I was lucky enough to come to Hawaii and speak at an event that Hawaii Business Journal hosts every year. And after my talk, you came up to me and you said something to the effect of, you know, I didn't realize that I had been fighting anxiety all my life until I gave up drinking 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So would you have called yourself a functional alcoholic?
Actually, not to brag, but I was a high-functioning alcoholic. Yeah, I was definitely a high-functioning alcoholic, you know, and I don't think that my drinking actually affected my career negatively for the first two decades I drank. I think it was only towards the end when things started to, progress, you know, like the disease of alcoholism does, to where I was not functioning. I was not able to overcompensate for my drinking towards the end. Yeah. When I put down the shovel, the hole was deep enough.
You know, I mean, first of all, it was a different era, but there are ways that sort of partying and even just working through an addiction can fuel us, I guess.
Yeah. So, I mean, the social acceptance of drinking and what defined somebody that was a problem drinker was probably different 30 years ago when I, you know, 40 years ago. Hmm. At the same time, I had my own rules. Every person that drinks too much has their rules. And what happens is the rules that you create for yourself as it relates to your drinking, the line just keeps moving over time, right? So what you wouldn't do in the beginning of your drinking career, those lines become, you just keep moving to the right, right? So one of my lines was that I would never drink during work hours, unless it was a drinking function after work or whatever. And so that kept me on the right side for many, many, many years, just avoiding drinking during the actual work hours. So that allows somebody to hide it a little better, yeah.
So you wouldn't drink during work hours, but would you drink after work most nights?
Yeah, no, every night, yeah, absolutely.
And you still got up?
Well, you know, tolerance and all that good stuff. I don't miss the hangovers, I'll say that. I usually didn't have like a hangover that you remember from college, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you're curled up around the toilet for a day after. That wasn't the normal experience. It was more just, I didn't normally wake up with a blasting headache. I would just be groggy, you know, and then drink a lot of coffee and off I go and make it through the day. I honestly believe that one of the reasons I was able to function as well as I did, given the circumstances, was that I had this anxiety that I didn't know about, because the anxiety kind of keeps you in line, right? It kind of keeps you on edge. Mm. It kind of gives you this awareness of the danger you're in. Mm-hmm. If nothing else, I think it made me more careful. It's almost like the antidote to drinking is anxiety, because anxiety like keeps your guard up. Mm-hmm. Whereas when drinking, it puts your guard down. And I don't know this for a fact, because I didn't know, as we talked about, I didn't know I had anxiety until after I stopped drinking, because I was self-medicating for decades, right? What feels like anxiety to me now felt like I need a drink then.
It feels like that to me every day. No, because honestly, I mean, I'm not an alcoholic, but I have been struggling to give up drinking for years. Yeah. For the same, you just put it so well, because you know that drink is going to take that feeling away.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for me, it wasn't one. But so for me, the definition of an alcoholic isn't necessarily somebody that drinks every day. You can have a non-alcoholic that drinks 7 days a week and an alcoholic that drinks once a month. To me, it's when you take that first drink and you stop. In my journey, one of the things was, if you think of it as like where I was trying to get to deal with whatever my mental issues were and are, it was, okay, there's the starting point and then there's a line where it's like, I feel good. And then there's a line, then there's a space, and then there's another line where I drank too much. And then there's all that space beyond I drank too much, right? And so the goal, obviously, was to get into that sweet spot between the two lines, right? In the middle ground, where I felt good, but I hadn't drank too much. And what I found was, over the years, the space between those two lines kept getting smaller and smaller. And those two lines almost became one, where I could never get there. I hadn't had enough, or I had too much. But that was part of the progression of the disease. There was no sweet spot anymore.
So you say that you were the gold star successful alcoholic for 20 years.
30.
30?
Yeah. I'd say the last two or three were not very successful.
What started to happen?
Just an acknowledgement that I knew that I had a problem, you know, and you know, at some point, when do you decide to do something about it? So I actually went to recovery meetings when I was in my late 20s. So it wasn't like I was walking around the last 20 years of my drinking, thinking that I didn't have a problem. That was the worst case. Like they say in recovery, they say the worst thing to have is a belly full of beer and a belly full of AA, because now you know you have a problem, right? You can't ignore what you know. I knew I had a problem. It just was a problem I chose not to deal with. And I'm thinking one of the reasons why is because alcohol had such a great effect for me, because it was my anxiety medication. Yeah.
And when did you start drinking heavily?
So drinking was, you know, culturally acceptable, even as a kid. Like, we probably started drinking on weekends, you know, 16.
Yeah.
By the time I was graduating college, I was pretty much like a daily beer drinker at 22, 23. And so then it just kind of went from there. But yeah, it didn't take long.
You were in your late 20s, but you knew you had a problem.
Yeah.
Why didn't you do anything about it? What stopped you?
Why doesn't anybody do something about a problem? So if you look at statistics on this particular disease, you'll know that most people never get help.
Yeah.
And then the vast majority of people that do get help don't succeed. It's a very small success rate of people that actually are able to quit, right? And to quit successfully for long periods of time or for, you know, forever. So I think that I'm very fortunate and blessed that somehow I'm one of those people in the minority that actually has been successfully not drinking for 15 years, one day at a time, you know?
Yeah.
You know what it is more? I think the biggest issue for me and for, I believe to be a lot of people, is the thought of not drinking for the rest of your life, which is kind of what you're faced with once you have that understanding that this is what you're going to need to do. You know, mm-hmm. Like if you know that that's the only solution is to stop, that's a pretty big deal. Right? It's a horrible thought. So until you actually go there and you hear from somebody, you do not need to quit drinking for the rest of your life. You just need to not drink today. Can you not drink today? And once you start to get into that day by day thing, which is, you know, what we all hear about recovery, right? It's one day at a time. But that's so true. Biggest issue is when you're by yourself in your headspace, saying, how could I possibly do this for the rest of my life? But I'll do it. And then the other thing is, was I was going to quit drinking tomorrow for about 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, anxiety is not dissimilar. When you're in the throes of anxiety, you can't see a way out except that this is how everything's going to feel for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And for me, the only successful way to treat my anxiety when I'm in a really bad spot is to literally, sometimes it's 3 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's I'm going to breathe in and breathe out and count my breath for an hour.
Yeah.
And if I think beyond what's going to happen this hour, I'm just going to pull myself back in and count.
Yeah. Sometimes it's by the minute, right?
That's right.
You know, that's when somebody's in early sobriety, like that's how they have to operate too.
Hmm.
To get through the next minute, get through the next hour. And a lot of times that's why people go to meetings, right? Is to get rid of that feeling. One of the best books I ever read was, you heard of the book Power of Habits by Charles Duhigg, yeah?
Charles Duhigg, yeah.
That book starts, it talks about how Alcoholics Anonymous kind of came up with the solution for changing habits in the 30s, but they had no idea what they were doing. It just happened to work within the theory that, you know, a habit is a three-step process, right? It's the stimulant for the behavior. It's the behavior, which in this case is drinking. And then that's the perceived reward for the behavior, which is the feeling you get, right? And so when Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob started creating, what they did was anytime somebody would feel like they needed to drink, the idea was to go to a meeting or talk to another alcoholic. And then the expected reward for going to a meeting is you feel better, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't break a bad habit without creating a new good habit. You can only replace a habit. You can't just break a bad one and not do anything is the point. So the meetings were the drinking, right? That was the action. I feel like drinking. So now instead of drinking, I'm going to go to a meeting. And after the meeting, I feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, if you keep doing that over and over again, the good habit starts to take over for the bad habit. Although the bad habit, to the theory of the book, is it never goes away completely. So if you stop practicing the good habit, the bad habit could come back because it's not a conscious decision. Habits are, they're in the very base spinal part of your brain, right? Habits are in the same part of our brain that control our breathing, our eyes blinking.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say, how, why didn't you deal with it? I wasn't able to stop blinking. I wasn't able to stop breathing. You know what I'm saying? That's where that habit is in my brain, right?
So what was it like the first time you actually had to sit and feel anxiety and not take a drink?
And honestly, I don't even remember why I ended up going to the doctor for anxiety. I wouldn't even know what that was. Because to me, it's like, okay, what are my symptoms? Anxiety and alcoholism, you can't do a blood test and tell somebody they have anxiety. It's pretty much asking questions. I remember the first year that I was sober, I had what is typically, you know, called the pink cloud, where I just, everything felt so much better and great. And so I was really blessed to have that. I didn't struggle that much. I knew I was going to be okay. And I felt great about it. And somewhere around a year, right after I'd been sober a year, because I remember after I'd hit a year, I was so focused on getting to a year, I didn't really have a plan after that. And so then I'm like, okay, so this is great. Okay, I've been sober here. Now what? Right? Like that whole goal went away. And now I was left with, okay, what? And that's when I think once that pink cloud went away, I think that that's when my normal human feelings started bubbling up and all the stuff. And at some point, I felt like something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was.
What did it feel like, the feeling that something was wrong?
I was just stressed all the time. I was reading something the other day, more about, I don't know if you can relate to this, because I totally related to it. And it was an actual story. I almost sent it to you. It was a story about overachievers. Anxious overachievers. And you might even have been in the damn
story. You've got to send me the damn story.
But anyway, it was talking about how a sign of an overachiever is somebody that knows in their head, they hear from their superiors and their coworkers that they're doing a great job, but in their gut, they just have this dreadful feeling they might get fired tomorrow.
Yep.
Can you relate to that? Because that's me. I have no rational reason why I should be worried about getting fired. I am been told on a regular basis, I'm doing a great job. And this has been the case for my whole life. And yet somehow, like somewhere deep down, I'm like, am I going to get fired? Like, you know, it's like the devil and the angel on your shoulders, right? Like the anxiety is the devil talking to you. I don't know.
Do you think you always had that and that's why you drank? Or is it just not that simple?
I don't know. That's a good point. I never thought about it until I started talking to you. I never put the two together that the reason why I didn't start feeling this until I was in my 50s was because I had been drinking until I was in my late 40s, right? But it's become pretty clear to me that that must have been part of it, that it made it hard to quit because it was doing a job for me. It was medicating. I think people use it for anxiety all the time. They just use it like once in a while, though, because they're not anxious all the time.
Oh, I disagree with you. I think people use it all the time, all the time. I mean, there's a reason why every single social function pretty much that we have has booze. You know, I mean, I think that it's to your point, it's just become such an okay lubricant for our anxious feelings as we move about the world that we forget what a powerful drug it is, you know? And I will share my own journey as someone who I don't think is an addict, but as someone who is definitely to avoid feeling anxiety, whether I'm living my life or on a plane or it's just 4 o'clock.
Oh God, I used to love to get drunk at the airport before I got on planes.
Oh God.
I convinced myself I had a fear of flying. And then after I got sober, I realized I didn't have a fear of flying. I had a fear of not drinking.
But a doctor did say you have anxiety. You took medicine, right? If I recall from our conversation.
Yeah, I'm on some low dosage of anxiety meds, although I noticed I don't feel any better from it. And I haven't gone back to my doctor to talk to her about it, but that's because I'm a male and I don't go to doctors. So.
Jeez. Just maybe promise me you'll just make an appointment.
I will. It's been like a year and she said it was a really light dose.
But talk to me about the year. I mean, it would make sense to me that once the act of not being a drinker could make you anxious, it's a huge shift in your life. And so that a year later, after the euphoria sort of honeymoon has worn off, you sort of wake up and you're like, oh, wait, this is it. Is this the rest of my life?
Yeah, that's the part I can't figure out is why this happened. Like, it still seems odd to me that I would have been sober a couple years and things are going great. And then all of a sudden, I'm starting to feel all this anxiety. And so there is that lag time where I didn't notice it. And so I can't say for sure I had it all along. It wasn't like it came out of, you know, this and immediately said, I'm anxiety day one of not drinking. It wasn't that way. And so I can't know for sure.
How was your experience at work different once you became sober?
I feel like I was probably a little more comfortable at work because, you know, you're on your best behavior all the time, you mm-hmm. know, not mm-hmm. compromised. That hasn't changed that much, to be honest with you, because that was my sober time beforehand too, right?
Right, right.
So, yeah, for that particular block of time in my life, I was always sober. So, yeah, no change.
What would you tell someone who's listening right now, who's maybe struggling with an addiction and worried about what's on the other side?
You know, if you just reach out to somebody that can relate to what you're going through, somebody that might be in recovery that can appreciate. Nobody can know what somebody that's struggling with addiction is going through if they haven't gone through it themselves. Mm-hmm. There's so much help out there for people with addiction. It's just there's meetings going on around the clock, around the world. You know, it's free. You could go to meetings. Some people go to 4 meetings a day when they first are trying to get sober. You got to connect with the recovery community because they're the only ones that can help. But I will say this. Let's just say you're in a recovery community. And people love to say, I've been sober for 10 years and my life is beyond my wildest dreams. You know, before I started drinking, I was in jail. I was blah, 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 blah. And you hear these stories over and over. And then somebody said something a few years back that I related to because I wasn't sure my life was getting better beyond my wildest dreams. I think that's a big promise to make. And so mm-hmm. somebody said, I can promise you this. If you stop drinking, your life will be different. And I thought, well, that is true. Different doesn't make the same promises beyond your wildest dreams, right? But for the most part, beyond your wildest dreams is different too, right? It's a subset of different. So it can be that way, but I guarantee you it won't be the same. And if you don't like the way it is now, I can promise you it will be different. And if different sounds better than the path you're on, I would give it a shot. I will say that my life is better, but I mean, it's very different, right? But yeah, the challenges are, and this is what they'll tell you, is now you have to deal with your feelings too, right? And that's part of anxiety is dealing with feelings. And I didn't have to deal with feelings for a very long time. And so that's a challenge for anybody that's waking up from the long sleep of alcoholism is you're going to have to deal with feelings. And you're going to have to deal with a lot of baggage too, because you're going to have to, you know, typically you've wreaked some havoc along the way. So you're going to have some people you need to, especially family, that you're probably going to have to repair some relationships. And that's hard, right? That's mm-hmm. really hard. But it's a blessing because once you get through it, you know, life gets better.
My last question is one that may sound kind of funny, but it ties into a larger agenda I have. So just bear with me.
Okay.
Do you think that if you had been raised in a world, which sounds like you weren't, and most of us weren't, where like feeling your feelings felt comfortable, normal, you had words to put around them. Obviously, addiction is a disease. But would something have been different about your turning to alcohol to sort of mask and avoid uncomfortable things?
Probably. The thing is, I don't think I consciously turn to alcohol when I started drinking as a teenager. You know, you're just doing it because it's what everybody's doing, right? You're experimenting. I do think that if I was a little healthier mentally, you know, as a young adult, looking back, the motivation, unconscious in many cases, motivation for drinking wouldn't be there. So I think it's possible that that was the case. Mm-hmm. Because I was raised in a family, even though I had a really great, you know, mother and father and brother and friends. I just can't complain. But there was a little bit of that in my family, traditional kind of 50s family, where you don't talk about that stuff, right? So that was definitely part of my upbringing, was we just didn't talk about that stuff.
Now my conversation with Donna Volpita. Donna is an author and educator, and she takes a brain-based approach to increasing mental health literacy. She's co-founder of the Mental Health Literacy Collaborative, and I spoke with her about why her work is so important and how she's tackling this monumental challenge in our society. I want to actually start with a question while we're talking about literacy and getting the correct terms. Why is resilience so important? And why is resilience really at the heart of a lot of the sort of research and case around mental health literacy?
I like to define resilience as our response to any challenge, good, bad, big, or small. Mm. So we're all going to face challenges in our lives. And those challenges, the smaller challenges, actually set us up to be able to handle those bigger challenges. And one of the things that we need to understand is how important challenges are for our mental health, that we feel like we are strong enough to handle challenges, that when we see a challenge ahead of us, we say, okay, I can do this. I have the strategies. I have supports. I have a way to handle this. I actually say that violence, anxiety, and depression, sort of a lot of the stuff that we're seeing in mental health, mm-hmm. the opposite is action, is knowing what to do, is having a way to handle that challenge.
Hmm. Challenges are important for our mental health. Why?
Well, it's interesting because, as I have said to you, that I have sort of two hats here. I talk mm-hmm. about brain science, and then I talk about the importance of mental health literacy. So when we think about the brain, we have neurochemicals. When we struggle, I say that neurochemicals are kind of like text messages that drive our behavior. It tells us what we should be doing. When we handle a challenge, we get a release of neurochemicals that are really important to the brain. So as we handle those challenges, as we struggle and we finally succeed, we get that neurochemical response of things like dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, these things that are so important that say, wow, you're worthwhile. Wow, you're a good person. Wow, that felt good. Do it again. Wow, people love you. And when we struggle and we get that really great yes, when we finally succeed at something, we say, you know, self-esteem isn't a gift you can give someone. It's a neurochemical response you rob them of if you don't let them struggle. So when we handle challenges, that sets us up. Our brains, when we're born, we need security. We need autonomy. We need this feeling of, wow, we're important. We can do things. And if we don't handle challenges, we don't get those neurochemical responses that tell us that we're important, that we can do things, that we're strong, all of that. So, you know, when we handle challenges, when we build that resilience, it drives us to do more.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
From LinkedIn News, I'm Leah Smart, host of Everyday Better, an award-winning weekly podcast dedicated to personal development. Whether you're looking for ways to shift your mindset or seeking more fulfillment in your life, we've got you covered.
You can build internal resources. That's what the study of psychology is about, building internal resources.
Turning towards is one of the most important elements of successful relationships, no matter what kind of relationship it is.
The thing that underpins all of this productivity stuff is finding a way to make the journey itself enjoyable. The journey is the destination.
The beauty of uncertainty is infinite possibility. When you don't know what's next, you don't know what's next. And thus, anything can be next.
Join me as we dive into captivating stories and research-backed ideas that have empowered me and others to lead lives with more clarity and intention. Every day better, making growth an everyday practice. Listen to Every Day Better on the LinkedIn Podcast Network, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's really important for people in the business world to hear this because there can be a sort of dismissive reaction when we start talking about mental health at work and the importance of learning about mental health and understanding it and shared language and, you know, encouraging people to talk about it, because some people will use that as an excuse for creating people who are, in their minds, weak, right? Who are snowflakes, who are all in their feelings and use feeling anxious as an excuse, right? Mm-hmm. I hear that all the time. Oh, these kids, all they do is learn about mental health and talk about their feelings, and it's making them weak. But you're saying the total opposite.
Well, in some ways, what I'm saying is what we have done, how we have handled mental health in a lot of ways has been counter to the way that we should. That when we understand the brain, we understand the need for support as people are handling challenges. So often we have three types of leadership. One is authoritarian that says my way or the highway. We have these high expectations. If you don't meet it, tough, you know, we have punishment here. Okay. You either meet my expectations or you don't. You listen to what I say. We have permissive leadership that takes away all of those expectations. Mm-hmm. And then the third type of leadership that time and again has been shown to be the most appropriate and the most effective is a leadership that says, I'm going to have high expectations. I'm going to give you challenges, but I'm going to give you the support to get there. Mm-hmm. And that is what we need to be doing. So often we're either doing the authoritarian of, oh, these kids are snowflakes, they can't handle this. Or, oh, we don't want to give them challenges because they might, you know, we're afraid that we're going to hurt their mental health. But what we really need to do is we need to have high expectations, but we need to get the supports, the scaffolds to help people make it so that they can handle those challenges and give them the supports. And then gradually we can, you know, remove those supports and have people feel like, okay, I can do this. The way to address mental health is to really handle those challenges with the support so that we have a way to succeed.
Maybe you'll define mental health literacy for us and sort of tie this back into why mental health literacy is so important for leaders and everyone in between. Yeah.
Completely agree. I think it's really important. One of the things that we found, and I co-founded the Mental Health Literacy Collaborative in order to make mental health literacy foundational in pre-K through 12 schools. We started there last year saying we need to get mental health literacy in schools because there were laws being passed requiring mental health literacy, but it wasn't moving into the classrooms. And a primary reason for that is people don't know what mental health literacy is. So we'll start with a definition. Mental health literacy is universal programming that teaches four critical concepts. The first is understanding how to foster and maintain mental wellness. So how do we keep ourselves mentally healthy? The second is understanding common mental health disorders and treatments. So when we have an understanding of what those common mental health disorders are, it helps us to be able to talk about them appropriately. Mm. The third is understanding how to seek help effectively. And part of that is understanding when we're seeing the beginnings of some signs and symptoms and who do I go to for help? How do I access that treatment? And the fourth is understanding how to reduce stigma. Mm. So those critical concepts give a foundation and a language for people to begin to have open conversations. Mental health literacy comes from health education, health literacy. We know a lot about our health, but we don't know a lot about mental health, which is what feeds into that stigma and what feeds into us not having those open conversations.
Right. And also just misinformation, right? Not meant in a negative way, but passed along because we don't truly understand it.
Absolutely. And mentalhealthliteracy.org has a great triangle where they talk about the language around mental health and that there's so much misinformation out there. And they have this pyramid that has four levels. The first level is doing pretty well. You know, mentally, everything's going pretty well. Their second level is mental distress. And that's those everyday challenges that we have. And our brains are meant to have mental distress. We're meant to handle those everyday challenges. I have a work presentation that I'm nervous about. I have to make this new recipe. I've got people coming over for dinner. These are mental distresses, not big deals. We've got to handle them. The third level is mental health problems. Those are bigger problems that we have to face, but we face them in life. Maybe I have, you know, a family member in the hospital. Maybe I'm sick, whatever it is. I've lost my job. Those are bigger challenges that we need to handle, mental health problems. The fourth level is mental health disorders. And those are actually disorders that are diagnosed through a psychiatric doctor and that we can treat. And they are treatable. And the interesting part is those four levels are not a continuum. I could have bipolar disorder. I could have a relative in the hospital. I could be giving a work presentation, and I could be doing pretty well overall. Mm-hmm. It's not a continuum. People with diagnosed mental health disorders can do very well in life. It's treatable.
How are we doing in the U.S. when it comes to mental health literacy in education, more generally in civic life, and then at work?
Well, one of the things I said was that we started off with saying that we wanted to make mental health literacy foundational in pre-K through 12 schools. The feedback that we have gotten over the past year is it needs to be schools and communities. Everyone needs to understand this, whether it's teachers, parents, workplace. Everyone needs to understand mental health literacy because we didn't get it when we were in school. So it's important to get this understanding through every different sector. So we have expanded in that, and we are not doing very well. One of the things that we found is, you know, legislatively, we're starting in terms of schools. And I think about 20 states now have legislation for mental health literacy, and very few classrooms actually have mental health literacy that is being implemented, mostly because people don't even know what mental health literacy is. it's, you know, even people at the state level who were part of passing the legislation don't know what it is. So at the Mental Health Literacy Collaborative, one of our primary goals is to let people know what mental health literacy is, why it's important, and how to bring it to your community, no matter which community you're in. And so we have an advocacy toolkit that's a free download that just gives people information. And our goal is to get people to work together. We're sort of a hub of how can we get this to people? And we are not doing well in terms of mental health in the US. The US Surgeon General in 2022 released a framework for workplace mental health and well-being. And a lot of what is in that report really ties back to mental health literacy, but it doesn't necessarily address it.
I want to talk a little bit about the brain science and the basics. You have a really wonderful way of communicating sort of brain science 101. And I'd love you to just pull some pieces out that you think are relevant. If you're a manager, most of the people who listen to this show are managers and executives and people who are interested in this stuff and want to help advocate for better mental health in their organizations. Where do you start with the brain science?
I think one of the most critical things that we can understand is that the primary needs of the brain are a sense of security, so safety, and a sense of autonomy. Our brains are wired to want to succeed. Our brains are also wired to protect us. The most important job of the brain is to protect us. So our brains are wired in a way that when we are threatened, we go into that fight, flight, or freeze mode. Mm-hmm. And when we're in that fight, flight, or freeze, we make decisions that aren't necessarily in our best long-term interest. So as a manager, thinking about how I can have the people in my workplace feel safe and secure and feel like they can have autonomy, that they can succeed and feel good about themselves. They can get those neurochemicals by handling challenges and feeling successful. But the other piece about the security is understanding that because our brains evolved during a period where we realized that living in communities was really critical for our survival, our brains learned to respond the same way to social threats as we do to physical threats. So just like a car coming at us is going to put us into fight, flight, or freeze so that we can get out of the way of the oncoming car quickly and survive, when we have a social threat, we will also go into that fight, flight, or freeze. And in the model that I created, we have an acronym, REACTS, that the social threats to the brain are respect, equity, alliances, control, territory, and similarity. So if we have a threat to any one of those social threats, we also go red alert and go into that fight, flight, or freeze mode. And we say and do things that might be more emotional and might more likely to have us do things that are in our short-term interest to get us out of the way, but not necessarily in our long-term interest. So that's where we see those emotional responses. And one of the things that we're seeing is that people are having more of those emotional responses because media and social media companies are hiring neuroscientists to figure out how to trigger that response through getting us into that emotional part of our brain and getting us to react. So we're sort of overfeeding that.
Can I ask you a question on that point? Because a lot of what we talk about here on The Anxious Achiever is how our workplaces can also trigger those responses, whether intentionally or not, you know, and cultures of fear, using anxiety as motivation. How do other people, and especially in a professional setting or a school setting, you know, a really competitive school setting, or like I live in a town where all the high school students, you know, are driven up a wall about, you know, are they going to be prepared to get into the best possible college? Like, how do we also socially trigger these fear responses at work? And what do we need to know about that?
We do it all the time. We think that that is going to help. And one of the things about the brain, we think of decisions we make as good versus bad. Like I made a good decision or a bad decision. Our brains don't think in good, bad. Our brains think in long-term versus short-term. So to our brains, our decision is this going to help me in the long-term or is this going to help me in the short-term? And when we are always in that competitive mode, we're sort of anxious and in that fight, flight, or freeze, we're looking for those short-term decisions. So we're more likely to make decisions like cheating, stealing, things that aren't necessarily good for our society. for our mental health when we are in that mode. Yeah. And we use a creature that we use, the grasshopper, this grasshopper mode, fight, flight, or freeze. And that when we are there, we're not making those decisions that are best for our long-term mental health. We're not making decisions that are best for our societal health.
So just to connect dots for listeners, although I know my listeners are extremely smart, if we had better literacy around this stuff, maybe we could stop doing it so much and people would be a little bit healthier at work.
Well, and not only that, I mean, what we're doing and we've always done for mental health is reactive. We wait for something, you know, a disorder to begin to develop, and then we go and we treat it. And so we like to say that's sort of like Smokey Bear teaching us how to put out fires, but not how to prevent them. And mental health literacy is preventative. It's how do I foster and maintain my mental wellness? How can I keep my brain healthy? How can I recognize if I'm starting to have problems? So, you know, early intervention is critical. We know that from health.
in my dream world, you know, we get the titans of industry as they're still in school, sort of mini titans, and give them an education about this stuff, not about the, as you say, the all the disorder and preventative stuff, but about why this makes you stronger and better, you know?
And again, if you're going to get into the business schools, let's talk bottom line.
Yep.
Globally, an estimated 12 billion working days are lost every year to depression and anxiety at a cost of $1 trillion per year in lost productivity. So the bottom line is getting hurt. And the other part of that is the saying of you're only as healthy as your least happy child. So when we look at the fact that the U.S. Surgeon General has said the youth mental health crisis is the crisis of our times, our kids are struggling. Mm. It's a critical issue.
I want to talk a little bit about the role of mental health literacy in helping what in many, now this is a question of privilege for sure, but what in many circles has become almost an addiction to achievement? When you look out and dealing with high school kids, college students, in the workplace, in your own field of education, what do you think about the idea of being addicted to achievement and how can better mental health literacy help?
The youth right now, and one of the things that we really have to recognize, particularly in the adolescence right now. So adolescence as a brain period has actually expanded.
Say more about that. What does that mean?
That they believe that, so adolescence is really the transition period between the childhood brain and the adult brain. It's a really big period of transition. And they used to think it started at about 13 and went to about 20. They believe that period where the brain is really in transition has expanded. And they're not exactly sure of the reasons, but they believe that one of the things is that we're having a lot more novel experiences now. As our brain moves out of adolescence, it becomes less plastic, less able to change. So the brain is sort of saying, wait, I shouldn't solidify as much yet because there are so many changes. So, but everything about what that period is supposed to do, so much of it was undermined by COVID and what was happening. And, you know, the idea of adolescence is we move away from our families. You know, we move towards our friends. We take risks. And so much of that is so important that kids move towards that independence and taking risks. And a lot of adolescents weren't able to do that.
And still aren't because of financial constraints.
Because of a lot of constraints.
Yes.
And I believe that as parents as well, and I am the parent of four adolescents at the moment. So I will say that, you know, one of those social threats to the brain was territory. When it's our kids, our project, our whatever it is, we tend to go into that protective state. And so much of that now is also aided by technology. We have ways of over-monitoring our kids and, by the way, over-monitoring our employees. And what that does is that undermines the idea of trust. So when we're being monitored, our brains sort of say, well, let me see what I can get away with. Let's do that short-term decisions. Trust is much more of a long-term. And adolescents need to have that experience of building trust. And so I think this started with, are they addicted to achievement? Yes, because that's almost the only thing they've been able to do, that they can get those achievements through academics, through sports, through all of those things. We're enabling them to do that, but anything outside that box, they're not allowed to do anymore.
That's right. That's right. And that's also how they feel loved. My last question is really a zoom out. Donna, we are pairing your interview with the interview of a man who's in his 60s, who is the publisher of a magazine. And he is an alcoholic, but he was drinking for 30 years. And only when he stopped drinking did he realize that he had been drinking all those years in a way to not feel anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that the juxtaposition of your stories was really powerful because I think that so many of us can relate to the feeling of acting out, doing something to not feel things that are hard and that we don't really understand or have language for, but we know we don't want to feel them and our brain doesn't want us to feel them. And to me, that's part of why mental health literacy is so, so crucial. You know, I asked him, I said, like, if you had learned this in school, do you think your path would have been different? And he said, well, I mean, I probably still would have been an alcoholic because it's a disease, but like, yeah.
Well, it's a disease, yes, and I understand that, but we're seeing an increase of a lot of these behaviors, and the behaviors are kind of the tip of the iceberg. We have a visual, and maybe you can add it, that was created that really has the iceberg, and we're treating behaviors, whether it's misbehavior in school or whether it's alcoholism, or, you know, that there are some behaviors that are happening because people are trying to numb the pain. And it's really important for us to realize where that comes from and how those decisions come. And we have right now 7.7 million adults have co-occurring mental health and substance use disorders. We don't know which came first, but we do know that we're seeing an increase. We're seeing an increase in so many of these things. They've done studies where social pain is very similar to physical pain. And there was a study that was done where they were able to look at social pain, track social pain and physical pain. And aspirin, a Tylenol, affected social pain just as much as it did physical pain. So when we're doing this, we're numbing that social pain. So we have to understand it. We have to understand, what are those strategies? What are those coping strategies that can help us rather than harm us? Because those maladaptive coping strategies, like drinking, like withdrawal, like there are so many of them. And that's part of mental health literacy, is understanding what are maladaptive strategies that might help us in the short term. They make us feel better in the short term, but not in the long term. So we have to begin to look at this as short term and long term as well.
That's right. That's right. And to understand, I think, you know, one of my biggest takeaways from our conversation is that challenge and pain is part of life. We can't avoid it.
And we shouldn't avoid it.
Right.
You know, avoiding challenges is exactly the opposite. It's what feels right to us. But I kind of like to say that that's like throwing water on a grease fire. It makes it worse.
Right. And to me, the perfect example, and I talk about this with Ken, is the fact that when you go to a social function that you don't know people or you're anxious about, what's the very first thing you do?
Often people get a drink, but
get a drink. Yeah, you grab a glass of wine. Like, it is the lubricant that society provides us, so we don't have to feel the discomfort of walking into that room, which is, of course, so universal.
And we want to be out of our comfort zone. That's where we have that growth. That's where we build resilience. But it's not comfortable, so we want to do that early and often. But it's a challenge.
Thank you so much for your work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And, you know, I'm happy to answer any other questions if people have them.
That's it for today. Our show is produced and edited by Mary Du. Our assistant producer and sound engineer is Nick Krinko. Many thanks to the LinkedIn Presents family and to all our guests for sharing their stories. If you love the show, tell your friends. I would love you to leave a review because they really matter in helping the show get found. You could also follow us or subscribe. If you have a question for me or you want to submit an idea for the show, find me on LinkedIn, where you can follow me, message me, I promise I'll write back, or subscribe to my newsletter for more from the anxious achiever world. Thanks for listening.